All right, we have two cases on our 3 o'clock docket. The first one is Hill v. State, and then we'll go directly into Spence v. State. Megan, if you'll please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Don Coffey for the appellant and Ms. Deborah Winter arguing for the state.
Thank you. Mr. Hossie.
May it please the court, counsel. Appellant has asked for oral argument to emphasize a few points and to discuss one new case. Police handcuff a person. Police conduct a warrantless search of a vehicle. Police find contraband and arrest the person. Counsel for the defendant asked the trial court to suppress the evidence. This describes two incidents almost a decade apart and very relevant here. On August 25th, 1999, the police in Arizona, and the defendant was Mr. Gant. On April 21, 2009, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Mr. Gant at 129 Supreme Court 1710. On January 29, 2008, it was the Fort Worth Police, and the defendant was Mr. Hill, our appellant. In Gant, the court concluded, police may search a vehicle incident to a recent occupant's arrest only if the arrestee is within reaching distance of the passenger compartment at the time of the search, or it is reasonable to believe that the vehicle contains evidence of the offense of the arrest. When these justifications are absent, a search of an arrestee's vehicle will be unreasonable unless the police obtain a warrant or show that the other exception to the warrant requirement applies. The Arizona Supreme Court correctly held that this case involved an unreasonable search, and accordingly, the judgment of the state Supreme Court is affirmed. Here, in this case, the Fort Worth police were patrolling an area that had been plagued by robberies. Police saw an SUV with tinted windows at first at the back of a McDonald's, then at a convenience store. Then the SUV traveled to a shopping center and did not signal a turn. As officers pulled in, the driver of the SUV, the appellant, got out of the SUV. Sergeant Enright testified that the police pulled guns for police protection and the defendant was handcuffed. The jury was excused and appellant's trial counsel then made an oral motion to suppress. Sergeant testified that 1 to 2 minutes after the appellant was cuffed, the police began a search of the SUV without the consent or without a warrant. Appellant's trial counsel objected because of the illegal arrest and the lack of probable cause. The trial court overruled the oral motion to suppress.
Does the testimony indicate during this 2 or 3 minute period, was the search done on the inside of the vehicle at the same time that the search was going on under the hood of the vehicle?
Judge, I think the hood part comes later.
Okay.
As I recall the facts, what I just quoted you there from Sergeant, the first witness to testify, he used the phrase, we began a search. Okay. And then I think later they get into trying to clarify, was the door open in plain view and those sorts of things. And much later, the hood part comes in, is my recollection.
We're not complaining about the stop.
We're essentially complaining about everything, but the focus is going to be on this part that we're talking about today.
Wow. Okay, let's one at a time. What's the problem with the stop if there's a traffic violation?
Let me restate that. No, we're not essentially complaining about the stop.
Okay.
But don't want to waive anything. But our focus at Judge is, as I'm saying, it's on the Gant issue. Enright testified that after the defendant was handcuffed, the other point I wanted to make. At this point, after the oral motion to suppress is overruled, trial counsel did not request a running objection. And so Enright then testified before the jury that after the defendant was handcuffed, he noticed officers pull the two passengers out of the back seat. So at this point, nobody's in the vehicle is the key point. Enright then made what he called a sweep of the vehicle, and he described that on page 62 of Volume 3, to be sure no one was inside with a weapon, were his words. And then in an area that Officer Elanis later testified, described as stuck down between the driver's seat and the console, Enright saw a brown paper bag partially ripped open with a clear plastic baggie with what he thought was crack cocaine. And I would submit to the court that was in an area where no person could be hiding with a weapon, which kind of goes back to what Enright was testifying about the reason for the sweep. So in this case, here the defendant is in cuffs, as was Mr. Gant in the Arizona case. The passengers have been removed. There was no area within the defendant's immediate control from which the defendant might gain possession of a weapon or destructible evidence. The Gant court quoted Katz on page 5 of the slip opinion, says, searches conducted outside the judicial process without prior approval by a judge or magistrate are per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, subject only to a few well-delineated exceptions. The key exceptions involved officer safety and evidence preservation, but they were not implicated where the subject is in handcuffs, as here and as with Gant.
About plain sight.
That is, as I'm about to go, Judge, that's what the state's going to argue, and our position is the contrary.
And so if there's meth laying on the console in plain sight, it just lays on the console until we get a warrant?
That on the console and stuck down between where they've described it here are two different cases. It
no,
was not.
You just said we're going to say, I thought you said plain sight's out the window.
No, Judge, I'm saying that's the state's argument, and I see where they're coming from, but and the hypo you just tossed was on the console. And what we've got in the facts here, it's between the console and the driver's seat, and it's kind of wedged in there. And it, as Alanis, the officer, testified, it's stuck pretty far down there.
We're going to draw the issue is that draw the issue, was it in plain sight?
That is an, I'm not saying that's the issue. That is an issue to consider.
A factual issue.
That's an issue of, in my view, fact and law.
Okay.
Thomas, where was Mr. Hill after he was handcuffed? Where was he placed, or where was he allowed to be?
I don't believe the record is totally clear. I don't think the record shows that he's in the police car, but it's clear he's in cuffs. It's clear he's cuffed behind his back, and he is some distance away.
Okay, thank you, sir.
The Gant court quoted Justice O'Connor as noting that lower court decisions seem now to treat the ability to search a vehicle as a police entitlement. Here the defendant was secured. There was no valid reason to search. Gant also notes that the privacy interests are at stake and deserving of constitutional protection. The key to the Fourth Amendment is the concern about giving police officers unbridled discretion to rummage at will among a person's private effects. Although it appears in page 16 of the slip opinion, the court says, quoting Gant, although it appears that the state's reading of Belton has been widely taught in police academies and that law enforcement officers have relied on the rule in conducting vehicle searches during the past 28 years, many of these searches were not justified by the reasons underlining the Chimmel exception. Countless individuals guilty of nothing more serious than a traffic violation have had their constitutional right to the security of their private effects violated as a result. Now, back to what Judge McCoy was asking earlier, the state clearly is going to be arguing plain view. Our position is it's an expectation of privacy in the area that we're talking about between the console and the seat. And now it's not the same as other expectations of privacy, but it's not out on top of the console. There is some argument of some degree of expectation of privacy is the point we're trying to make, Judge. And this also, and again, what going back to what the sergeant testified, that he was looking for a person, or he was doing a, quote, sweep to look for where somebody could be with a gun. Well, there's nobody that could fit down between the console and the seat. So this is beyond what he's testifying about.
Okay, are you drawing a distinction between it's in plain view, but it's between the seat and the console, and it's just laying up on the console? Is there something magical about between the seat? I mean, what if it was the butt of a gun sticking up between the seat and the console?
Judge, I'm not sure it's magical, but I think factually those are different situations. And I think I'm arguing that there's some expectation of privacy where it's crammed in there like the officers have described it.
So if it's in plain view, but it's an area where you expect privacy trumps.
That's the argument I'm trying to make, Judge.
Okay, I'm just...
I understand. Trying to focus. And we're both trying to get the issues narrowed. I understand, Judge. Now, turning slightly to the other area, the state has argued that the party must object each time objectionable evidence is offered, and if it comes in at any point, there is no reversal. Appellant contends that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for trial counsel not to obtain a running objection. And I would argue there is no legitimate trial. Now we've gone into the area of ineffective assistance where we've got to have something in the record to show what the trial strategy is. Judges, I would submit to you there's no arguable trial strategy to not simply saying to the trial court, Your Honor, maybe I have a running objection at this point. That did not happen, and I'm arguing there's no legitimate trial strategy reason not to take that simple step. Furthermore, there should have been a written motion to suppress with a full hearing, not a two-minute hearing, as you see in the record before you. And then if that's overruled, then get a running objection. And then everything that flows out of that should have been objected to or part of a running objection, such as the drugs, the gun, the lab result. Everything flows from this instance of ineffective assistance. What I'm asking the court to do here is find that Gant does apply in reverse. If the court believes error is not preserved, asking the court to look at the large number of lapses by the appellant's trial counsel, I submit to you that these all collectively go to the very heart of the adversarial system, and that there is no need for a further trial strategy explanation on behalf of trial counsel. I would submit to you that the ineffectiveness pervades this entire record. And with those comments, I'll sit down.
Ms. Windsor.
May it please court, counsel. I want to start off with addressing Arizona versus Gant. It really just doesn't have anything to do with this case. It's distinguishable. In Gant, the defendant was arrested for driving with a suspended license. That's the kind of offense that police are not going to expect to find evidence of that offense in the car. In our case, the defendant was ultimately arrested after the police, as they're looking in the vehicle, see the drugs. Once they've seen drugs in the vehicle, then they do have reasonable suspicion and to think that there could be further drugs in the car, that there could be evidence about those drugs, whether it's scales or drug notes or guns or other things. So I don't think Gant really has any application of this case.
Ms. Wins?
Yes?
Are we talking about before the vehicle is stopped? What did the officers have as a reason for stopping the vehicle? And here it was tinted windows and an improper turn signal.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So why would Gant not apply if those are both traffic or related to traffic offenses, not the tinted windows, but the turn indicator? And that's specifically what Gant's talking about, a traffic stop that's expanded without a warrant. I don't see how it's distinguishable as not applying.
Your Honor, it's one of those things, this is one of those cases, and I think Justice McCoy was maybe going this way, I hope so, that you kind of need to break it down step by step in terms of exactly what happened in the case, and I tried to do that in the brief. The first thing that happened, the officers noticed the vehicle, I'm going to say acting suspicious. I think it parked in one spot, it sat there a few minutes, nobody got out, it went to a restaurant, nobody got out again, sat there a few minutes, then... And so their attention is already on the vehicle. It's in a high crime area, so they're out kind of looking for suspicious behavior. But then when the vehicle, what they observe is the windows, number one, are tinted too dark, and then it makes the illegal turn. At that point, that does give them reasonable suspicion, and it provides a proper basis for the stop. Once they initiate the stop, the defendant and the front seat passenger just bail out of the car, leaving the doors open, which is a key point. The police at that point are quickly responding to that situation. One of the officers believes that he sees the defendant reach behind, and he's afraid that he's going for a weapon. They draw their guns. Everyone's attention is focused on the situation. They quickly get him handcuffed, pat him down, and then they go, and this is all happening probably faster than I can describe it. They go back to the car to look to see if anybody else is in there. Sure enough, there are other passengers that they couldn't see through the tent. They get them out. And at some point during this process, and I'm not sure exactly when, they can see the drugs in plain sight in the car. So once they had a proper basis to stop the car, defendant is out of the car. Under Terry, it's proper to basically handcuff him to sort of maintain the status quo, however you need to do that, to pat him down, to check for weapons, to check on the other people in the car. Then they see the drugs, which I think that's the huge difference. Gant was a case where he was just arrested for driving with a suspended license, and then they searched the car with nothing else and found drugs. I think it was in a backpack in the back seat, but you'll have to read the opinion to make sure I'm right on that. In our case, they had not actually arrested him for the tinted windows or the illegal turn. We don't know if they would have arrested him for that or not, but they didn't ultimately arrest him for that. Once they made the stop, then this whole thing ensues. They see drugs in the car, and that's what they ultimately arrested him for. So the arrested offense in this case was the drugs that were found in that car. Once they saw that, then they had reason to believe that there might be other evidence relating to that in the car. And sure enough, there was.
The briefing makes it look like there were additional drugs on the floorboard in the back. So is the ecstasy and the scales and something else, were those, I guess, in plain view or not?
I don't believe that those were.
Okay.
And I confess it's been a while
since I looked at the record
on this.
And does the record tell us if the front seat passenger was cuffed immediately, as was Mr. Hill?
I don't know if the record is as clear. I know Mr. Hill was because he's the one that they observed making the furtive gesture. Turns out he did not have a weapon on his person, but they couldn't know that at the time. I don't believe the front passenger was cuffed. I believe she was just taken out and isolated. I don't remember, and I think counsel addressed this, I don't remember where the defendant actually was placed, as Justice Myers had asked. I agree that he was placed in cuffs, and he was some distance away. I don't know if there was any information in the record beyond that. So I think, you know, Gant really does not apply to this case because of the way this whole thing ensued. And when you break it down, that they had reason for the stop, there had reason for a Terry frisk, and then you see the drugs in plain sight, that's how it just really starts to lose all similarity to Gant, despite the fact that it initially was they were pulled over for the traffic offense. One other point I want to make is as to the plain sight argument. Plain sight is plain sight, is my response. I don't think you can have an expectation of privacy with regard to something that you've left in plain sight. Once it was in plain sight, then the officers could see it. They were from a lawful vantage point. They weren't searching around in the car. They just, you know, the door was already open the way the defendant had left it. They could see that in there. The last thing, the ineffective assistance of counsel. I did not argue in my briefing, and it's not what we typically see the way that the search issue came up, but I think that there are certainly reasons counsel could have chosen to raise the search issue the way he did. I did not object or argue that he didn't preserve it because I think since they had an oral motion to suppress outside the presence of the jury, that as long as he didn't go in later and say no objection, which I don't believe he did, then he didn't have to object further after that was the position I took. Beyond that, we don't have a record from a motion for new trial in this case addressing any kind of ineffective assistance. This is not the kind of rare case that you see where you can establish ineffective assistance on the record that we have, and I would submit that the defense attorneys ought to be given the chance to explain why they did or didn't do things in this case, and that can certainly happen if this is raised in a writ.
I have a question.
Sure.
How many trial mistakes, trial mistakes, if we just call them that? Should defense counsel be allowed before it rises to the level of incompetence without anything more than what's in the direct record?
You know, I think it's something, you know, I hate to say this, but I think it's a case-by-case thing. I think it depends on whether you can say it's definitely a mistake, number one, or there could there have been some sort of trial strategy. I think it depends on the type of case it is, the facts that are involved, how strong a case was it for the state, what kind of argument was it for the defense, was it really going to go anywhere anyway. The case I looked at before coming up to argue today that this court recently came down with was the Aldrich case out of Denton. And I think, you know, if you look at that case, you look at this case, they are completely different. That case had things in the record that where counsel was clearly misstating the law. People were trying to correct him. He wouldn't listen to them. There were statements in the record. People were worried at the time of the trial that he was providing ineffective assistance. We don't have anything like that in this case. You know, for instance, on the motion to suppress, counsel could have believed that this wasn't a especially strong motion to suppress, which I would certainly agree with that viewpoint given my response, and that he may have just thought, you know, if I go in there and interrupt the trial to raise this issue, throw the state off their game, you know, maybe I'm going to get a little bit of strategic advantage by just making the prosecutor have to do this without having thought about it before.
Well, in this case, we had an issue dealing with the drugs in terms of whether they were in plain view or whether there was a proper search as far as the drugs were concerned. Then we have the gun that's under the hood of the car by the air cleaner. Then we have the issues dealing with whether there were proper objections made to comments that could have been characterized as a comment against a failure to testify. And then there's the bolstering argument. I'm just wondering if we don't finally get to the point of where there's a question to be raised on effective assistance of counsel with these multiple things that are raised by the defendant in his brief.
You could certainly have any case that comes before the court, you can certainly raise a number of issues as this defendant has done where you don't like the way your attorney handled the case. But what my argument is we ought to at least give the person who is being attacked and called unprofessional and incompetent a chance to address those in a writ hearing. This isn't a case where he's never going to be able to make his claims. He certainly can raise this in a writ, and it'll be addressed on the merits. But in this case, you know, I don't think he was ineffective on the motion to suppress. I think it was preserved. I don't think he had to file it as a written motion. I don't think he had to do it before trial. You know, if the prosecutor had been unprepared and just messed up and the trial court granted it, then that's going to end the trial if we don't have any evidence to go forward, and it would have been jeopardy bar, no state's appeal. There could have been valid strategic reasons to do it the way he did. The arguments, you know, I would disagree and say that they were not comments on failure to testify. It wasn't bolstering. It was the prosecutor wasn't offering her personal opinion. She was simply making reasonable deductions from the evidence. The comment on the failure to testify, I think, was really just a reasonable deduction from the evidence. We weren't pointing at what the defendant didn't say, you know, that his lack of testimony. We were just saying, you know, here's from the common sense, here's what the evidence showed. What do you think happened? So I think on the merits that he's wrong, but I think even just because you raise a whole bunch of ineffective assistance claims, there you may have some smoke, maybe, if you will, but you don't necessarily have fire there, and the writ process is certainly a better way to address that.
I think in Aldrich, the court even said, I have concerns as to whether this is effective, or this may be ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, the court did in Aldrich, and it was that. I think that is a case, if you want to see a case that on direct appeal, the record would be appropriate to address that. I think that's the kind of rare case that the Court of Criminal Appeals is talking about. If there are no further questions, the state would simply ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Windsor. Mr. Hussey?
Mr. Hussey, how do you address privacy, plain view, never the same thing? If it's in plain view, by definition, there's no expectation of privacy, or it wouldn't be in Plainview.
Judge, as I was reading this record, I'm sitting here thinking if you're driving a vehicle and you've got something out on the console, that's plain view. But if you've got it crammed down, essentially hidden to a large degree, and then because the police show up, you get out of the car and leave the door open, you still have some kind of expectation of privacy for what you've left there. That's my argument.
Right. Well, we just go back to our factual argument about was it in plain view or was it stuffed down between the seat? So, okay.
Okay. The last point I want to reemphasize in response to what the state has said is I do submit to you that Gant does apply here. And as I recall, as I read Gant, the main thing it keys on is the handcuffs. There's some discussion in the record here between counsel and the witnesses about was he under arrest, was he merely being detained? There's a lot of discussion about that. As I read Gant, the key is less what we call it and more that the fact that this guy is out of the way and he is some distance away, and that takes away the rationalization that law enforcement has used for 28 years, which basically gives them carte blanche to search. And I would submit to you that Gant is applicable. And for each and all of those reasons, we're asking that you reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing and your submissions today. Your case is submitted and you're dismissed. We'll next call our case number 5 on our docket today, Spence v. State.